You're tuning in to the Raised by Rentals program. This podcast will contain strong language and spoilers for decades-old media properties. Join us.
Welcome, everybody. This is a podcast where we examine pop culture franchises of the VHS era and improv new stories in a desperate and futile attempt to distract ourselves from the constant fear that an actual apocalypse could and likely will happen in our lifetime, and there's nothing we can do about it except imagine how we might improve our favorite movies, TV, and games. I'm Josh.
I'm Mike.
And we were raised by rentals. Mike! Wait. Hang on. I always say that. Time for something different. Justin!
Josh! Mike!
Oh, God. Hey! There's not multiple mics this time.
Yes, it's less confusing. We have one Josh and one Mike instead of Josh, Mike, Josh.
Exactly.
We got Justin, Josh, Mike. Mike, Josh, 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 something like that.
It's funny that you just slurred that because I literally just had to explain that to somebody yesterday at work when they asked me, why do I always introduce myself as Joshua Strasberg and never just Josh, like I say my full name, like why the Joshua? And people ask me in meetings, if they don't know me, they'll ask me if it's okay to call me Josh or if I prefer Joshua. And I will tell them the truth, which is that everyone calls me Josh, but I say my full name because there's so many S sounds in it that if I don't say Joshua, I'll end up saying Josh Strasberg and like slurring my own name. Which is embarrassing when you mispronounce your own name.
Right. Understandable.
Well, I'm Justin Strasberg.
Justin von Strasberg is our guest this week. This every other week? This bi-week? I don't know. Whatever our frequency of putting out episodes is. Justin, introduce yourself.
Hello, I'm Josh's brother.
That's all anyone needs to know. You have no identity of your own.
No, I am Justin von Strasberg. I'm Josh's older brother. And yeah, we watched movies together in the 90s. And we're going to talk about a few of those movies that we watched together in the 90s. So what movies are we talking about today? And what are we doing? I'm confused now.
I like how you just get to the point. That was good. Because yes. Mike's always telling me I need to stop burying the lead and just get to the fucking point already. So today we are going to talk about two movies from the VHS era that you and I, Justin, used to watch all the fucking time when we were younger, constantly, which is Solar Babies and Prayer of the Roller Boys.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, I can predict the future audience listening to the episode and they just heard some crickets and they go, wait, what?
I'll be honest, I have not watched Solar Babies since I was a child, and I don't know that I've ever seen Prayer of the Roller Boys all the way through.
Like, sacrilegious.
Seriously, this is one of those movies, like, in my head, I had the whole story, and then when I was rewatching it, I'm like, I don't remember any of this stuff. Like, there was a whole bunch I didn't remember at all, and I'm like, maybe I never watched this all the way through, but I will say, even now in 2024, I enjoyed the fuck out of both of them.
These are both movies that I think me and Josh both could quote lines from. Like, while we're watching it, we could say the next line. We could say the next line. We could say the next line.
And I was, too.
And this is, I could totally see, like, knowing both of you and watching these movies, I could totally see you guys digging this. Like, I could understand this being, like, childhood favorites. And I'm kind of ashamed of myself for not having seen more, like, seen Prayer of the Roller Boys more as a child, because I would have fucking loved it back then. I really enjoyed it this time. I'm like, damn, okay. I feel like I missed out.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's, like, an underrated classic that people dismiss because, you know, it's about rollerblading or Corey Haim is the main character. Right. You know, it's like
it's a Corey Haim vehicle. I think yeah. That's why people dismiss it.
Exactly. There's a lot of things about it that on the surface make it seem stupid. Like, wait, it's a Corey Haim movie where he rollerblades to fight crime? Is that what it is?
Specifically Nazis.
Yes. Yes, you're right. It's like
drug dealing Nazis.
Wait, let's say that again then. It's a post-apocalyptic sci-fi movie where one of the Corys rollerblades to take down a drug-dealing gang of Nazis.
Yeah, when you say it like that, it does sound kind of stupid.
but it's totally awesome.
Yes,
it's
it is.
So and fun.
I think it's one of Corey's best performances, too. I honestly do. I think he's great in the movie. There are some, a few little bits, but I think overall it's one of my favorite things that he did. I think, you know, Lost Boys is number one, of course, but I think you know, License to Drive and this are like second and third easily, in my personal opinion. But, you know, to each their own, of course.
After rewatching this, I have to agree.
Yeah, I agree entirely. Yeah, The Lost Boys and then this one and License to Drive are absolutely my favorite Corey Haim movies, like hands down, easy.
The only thing that I have to criticize with Corey Haim in this movie is this, and this is just a Corey Haim thing. He does it in every one of those movies. It doesn't matter how serious the conversation is. At some point, he's going to look down and he's going to look back up, like kind of like under his eyebrows with a weird smirk. He always does that damn like open mouth kind of like toothy smirk while looking up at you. What is that look?
Oh god, yeah, I could just like picture that face. You're totally right.
And I mean, it doesn't ruin the movie or anything. It's just like I notice it every time he does it. So as soon as he did it in this, I'm like, ah, there it is.
Oh yeah, no, he totally has quirks too. And Patricia Arquette is the same way. Like, I think that most of the actors in this movie, first of all, good acting. Like, I don't know the actor who plays Gary Lee, but Jesus, like, Gary Lee's like a creepy, scary guy.
He's a good villain, yeah.
I think the only bad actors in this movie, and that's because I think they were just giving shitty lines, was the bad cops, those two bad cops. Yeah. I think that they're like the weakest part of the entire thing. Like, even, you know, Gary Lee's associates and the Roller Boys, whether it's, you know, Bo Winkle or Bango or whatever. But even, you know, even the other side Roller Boys are all doing very good acting. And then the guy that's plays Speedbacker is awesome. Like, Patricia Arquette is great, except for there's a couple few scenes I think she overdid it. But overall, acting's great. You know, the person who plays, you know, Griffin's younger brother, Milty, is great. You know, he's a great. Again, he does overact, but again, he's a kid. You know, he's a child actor, so he's going to do it. You know, the guy who plays Pinky, the pizza dude, like, you know, they're all great in their own way.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, I totally agree. And while the kid might overact because he's a kid, he still sold it. Like, there was no point where I was like, ah, here's the kid actor. You know, that you get a lot in these, especially early 90s movies. But no, he fucking nailed it. And the thing with the other Roller Boys, like, every single one of them kind of exuded that like creepy villain vibe. I was like, they did it well. Like, this was a really well put together, silly movie. Like, it's a silly concept, but it works really well.
Yeah, like, you want to love Bango and then you want to kill Bango. You know, like, that's good acting when you can pull that off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I probably should have looked it up ahead of time to know who wrote the movie, but it wasn't somebody, you know, that I recognized. But I totally agree. I think that the script is really strong. The world building makes sense for what the movie is. And each of the characters was very distinctive. You know, you guys mentioned Speedbagger, Bango. I fucking love Bullwinkle. He's such a dick. And I love that because I hate him so much. I'm like, oh, it's so good. He's written so well. Like, when you hate a character that much, that's not easy to write, you know? And again, you know, Gary Lee and Griffin. And even though, there's so much fucking rollerblading in the movie, which is, you know, right in the title, it's a key feature of the movie. But if you just took the rollerblading out, it doesn't really affect anything else. You add this really great, you know, post-apocalyptic sort of like drug cartel movie, which quite frankly reminds me a lot of RoboCop in that way, or really more RoboCop 2.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's really, really strong. So, yeah, Prayer of the Roller Boys. Anyone's listening who has no idea what we're talking about, again, 1990 Corey Haim vehicle with Patricia Arquette, and it is fucking great. And pairing that with another movie from the VHS era that just a few years prior came out in 1986, also about roller skating for some reason, was Solar Babies.
You know, before we get into Solar Babies, I want to comment one last thing on Prayer of the Roller Boys. there's one scene that genuinely sent chills up my spine is when we see the Roller Boys skating all in line, like lockstep, like fucking Nazis goose stepping. Like the way they moved in unison like that, with that determined look on their face as they were coming at Milty and Griffin, I was like, Jesus Christ, that's creepy. Like, it was very well done. So even like the stuff that they don't focus hard on lets you know like who the bad guys are in that movie. And it's done with a lot of subtlety that I feel like is lost on modern films. And for it to be in such like a weird, like, fucking Corey Haim movie, it's like I was just really impressed with it. I'm like, damn, this should not be impressing me as much as it is.
Yeah, I agree, and I'm glad you mentioned that too, because again, I think that the Roller Boys, while on the surface very corny, I mean, they're called the Roller Boys and their whole thing is that they rollerblade, like that's kind of the whole point, but on the surface they're very corny. But yeah, exactly, they're like these Nazis that have these uniforms, they move in lockstep. They also do exactly what the Nazi party did, which is that they get to kids when they're young. They enlist the youth. They had their own like Hitler Youth program. They were handing out like food and comic books, and they were giving little kids jobs, like, you know, as like drug couriers, and, you know, putting them out on the street where they can make like real money in a society where the economy has completely crashed, and even the currency they're using is like a weird mishmash of like yen and dollars and bartering, you know. So it's a really, really smart movie, and I think it's so cool that they came up with this gang that is also very believable. Like all the arguments that they were making to Griffin and Milty about why they should join were really enticing and convincing, because you know in your head that these are racist assholes, but like they kind of have it good. You know, they got money and clothes and comfort and girls and parties. And it's like they made a really good argument, as opposed to other silly street gangs you see in sci-fi movies, like in, you know, Class of 1999. I fucking love that movie, but the gangs are ridiculous.
You know? Oh, God, yeah. but that's the thing. Like, I think you said about it's a smart movie, and it almost has no right to be as smart as it is. Like everything from the characterization to the plot of the movie, everything is so well done and well thought out that I feel like it's a shame that this movie is not more known. And I, like I said, I'm ashamed of myself for not going back and watching it before now. Cause this is definitely going to be something being added to my regular rotation. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I don't even remember how Josh and I discovered it, but I think we had a knack of knowing what was good in the, you know, late 80s, very early 90s when it came to the, you know, I guess B/C-tier movies. We just discovered good ones, a whole bunch of them, and they were just on VHS, and like Josh said, we would watch them all the time. Like there were weeks where we would watch this movie on repeat every day. And the same thing with, like, Solar Babies. Like, every day we would watch it.
Meanwhile, I was over there watching Three Ninjas, and Three Ninjas Kick Back.
we watched Three Ninjas, too.
Fuck yeah, dude. We love those movies. Wait, were those the Ernie Reyes Jr. movies, or am I thinking of a different ninja movie? Ernie Reyes Jr., who went on to be in the... Because I remember recognizing him in the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle movie. Like, you know,
I'm pretty sure he was in Three Ninjas. Now I gotta look it up.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he was too.
I was going to point out too, we were talking about like tics the actors have, and you know, Corey Haim has his little like side smirk that he does. And man, every time I see Jamie Gertz in a movie, like she just makes the same face, like somebody just like poked her in the butt crack, you know, where she's just like, ooh!
Dude, 100%.
Even Jason Patrick's the same way. Like, if you watch him in Lost Boys and you watch him in Solar Beam, he's like, he's doing that thing. He's doing that other facial thing. Like, all three of them, you know, Jason, Jamie, and Corey, they all have mannerisms that cross both movies and every other movie they've ever been in. And it's just, yeah, it's great. But Josh, describe Solar Babies to everybody. You gave them the little description of prayer. What's Solar Babies about?
Well, Solar Babies is another movie that's hard to describe, but it's also a post-apocalyptic movie where people like roller skate to save the day. You know, that's kind of the connection between the two. But in Solar Babies specifically, you have this society or that's farther in the future. It's more post-apocalyptic, and you have these kids, they're teenagers, they're orphans, living in an orphanage in the middle of some vast desert, and the government that controls this place, they control water like a currency. It's the asset that controls everything in their society, is, you know, who controls the water, and they, you know, they dole it out. And these kids, they live in this orphanage, and the way that they entertain themselves or, you know, have their recreation is that they play a sport called skateball, which is exactly like rollerball from the movies of the same name, both the James Caan one from the 70s and the 2002 remake with LL Cool J, where so they play this skateball game that's kind of like lacrosse on roller skates, and then they encounter what seems to be an alien intelligence that like leads them away from the orphanage to have like an adventure in the desert and eventually, you know, bring down the big bads. But it's a harder movie to describe. I don't know if we can do it in like, you know, one silly sentence, because, you know, we don't have drug dealing Nazis. But yeah, I mean, again, it's kind of like roller skating orphans in a Mad Max future.
Right. It
makes sense.
Roller skating orphans versus water Nazis with the help of space Jesus.
There you go. You nailed it.
All taking place in a Mad Max world.
Exactly.
Oh, it's so Mad Max beyond Thunderdome. It's like ridiculous. Like,
oh, absolutely.
When they go to Tire Town, they completely just like reuse the set from the fucking Road Warrior.
It's the only thing about the movie that I think after all these years, I wish they would have done differently. You know, depicting all the people who were outside of the orphanage. That's the only thing I wish they would have done different. I think it would have, again, they pulled very much from the Mad Max world. And like, yes, I guess it, you know, the world could go Mad Max-like if someone controlled all the water. But in reality, I don't think it would go that way. I really don't. Because they don't explain, you know, if anything else happened, you know, before the water was captured. That's kind of the one of the reasons we're doing this, is to explain a backstory for Solar Babies and maybe a future for the Roller Boys. But yeah, I don't know. I think the Mad Max approach was the wrong direction. But again, it played into it, and it was a thing that was popular at the time, you know.
And I will say Mad Max has kind of colored that type of story ever since its inception, because almost like think of every post-apocalyptic movie in the last like 20-30 years, they've all had some kind of like dried out desert look to them. You know, like granted, you do have the ones that kind of take place more in like a Fallout style universe where it's just like a ruined world. But so many of the stories, like I immediately thought of the Book of Eli, you know, where there's just like, hey, it's another desert with shanty towns and no water. You know, it's just like that pops up, or A Boy and His Dog. Like those kind of stories, they always have this weird Mad Max, like we live in a desert and water is scarce type of future.
I saw this on the IMDb trivia for Solar Babies, and I'm ashamed that I didn't think about it, which is that Tank Girl has almost the exact same plot, you know, specifically the movie from the 90s with Lori Petty and Ice-T. But yeah, it has almost the exact same plot with a, you know, evil government organization that controls all the water in society.
Mm-hmm. I genuinely love how ridiculous that movie is.
It's so good. It's stupid.
I love it. It's so dumb, but damn it, I love it.
It's so good. And the comics are fucking amazing. Oh my God, the comics are so good.
I think that version is even more believable in a sense, because there's still more of a society there. Whereas like in Solar Babies, the society is more, a lot more fragmented. Like you don't even, we're only seeing a little bit of it. But I think when Tank Girl, you actually, just in the bit that you see, you get a better handling on how the entire world, or at least the, you know, the United States is faring, or how it actually is. Because, you know, you see more people, there's more interaction, whereas, you know, you got Tire Town and Solar Babies and one village of people, you know, and that's not even an actual permanent village. It looks like that's probably a moving one, or at least partially moving. But yeah, okay.
Yeah. I think that the emptiness that you're talking about leads to sort of like the desperation that all the characters have in Solar Babies. I think it lends to this idea that, as they say several times in the movie, there's nothing out there, you know, and that's what the protectorate, this government organization that rules society, is what they want all the kids at the orphanage to believe. And we don't even necessarily know that that's true. We see a big empty desert, but for all we know, they could be sticking orphanages out in the desert on purpose. And you know, there's a lot more to the society that we're not seeing. But yeah, they're creating these isolated, hard scrabble environments for the orphans to live in so that they grow up, you know, tough and brainwashed and feeling like working for the protectorate is their only option in life because there's nothing else out there. And of course, our main characters find out that there is a lot more out there. To your point, there's a village of, you know, of a society that's, you know, kind of Native American and kind of Romani. There are these, like, you know, traveling natives. And then they find Tire Town, which is the sort of like, you know, industrial factory town where some of the refugees from the orphanage have gone to, like, find jobs and, you know, a place to live other than the orphanage out there in the desert. But then, yeah, we see all these protectorate people and even rich leaders in the organization who are dressed in the height of 80s fashion. There's clearly more out there. But what makes Solar Babies interesting is the sci-fi element of Bodhi. You know, like you mentioned, Space Jesus, which is completely accurate because that's exactly what he is. You know, he's a glowing orb that comes to Earth for some reason, and he talks to Lucas Haas because Lucas Haas is like the cute little kid protagonist in like every 80s movie.
Yeah.
But he performs miracles. He heals the sick. You know, it's Space Jesus, you know, and then of course, you know, the bad guys try to sacrifice him and, you know, he comes back. It's totally Space Jesus.
Yeah. I mean, they even call him the sphere of lungeness throughout, you know, most of the second half of the movie, right?
Exactly. Well, it's only like a couple letters difference from the sphere of lungeness.
Yeah. It's funny. Now I have to wonder, what was the movie that I just saw with Tegan recently? I had to stop and explain what Longinus was. Oh, it was Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. We finally watched that a couple of weeks ago. And spoiler alert, there's a subplot related to the Lance of Longinus, otherwise called the Holy Lance or the Holy Spear. That was, without getting too much into it, you know, there's a legend that the Roman centurion, who is mentioned briefly in the Bible, who stabbed Jesus in the side while he was on the cross to see if he was dead or not, and that spear that he was holding that pierced Jesus and was soaked in his blood later went on to become like a magical artifact that people have been fighting about, you know, throughout time because it holds some kind of special supernatural power.
Right. Well, it's kind of like the whole Shroud of Turin and stuff like that. You know, it's a holy artifact that a lot of stories like to use for a MacGuffin device.
Yeah, that's exactly the right word for that. Yeah, exactly a MacGuffin. So I do want to get into talking a little bit about how we can tell a story of our own and connect these movies or do something inspired by them. But since we talked about the cast of Prayer of the Roller Boys a little bit with Corey Haim, you know, we mentioned Jamie Gertz, we mentioned Jason Patrick, but man, I had forgotten what a great cast Solar Babies has too. Like I briefly mentioned, Lucas Haas is in there, you know, from Lady in White and Mars Attacks and a crap load of other movies from that time period.
Love him in The Righteous Gemstones right now.
Oh God, it's so good. Such a great show. I love it so much. And then I'm like looking at some of the other actors in the Solar Babies group, and it's like, I've seen these people somewhere. It's like the dude from 21 Jump Street and like that other dude, you know? And so when I look him up, it's like, yeah, Peter DeLuise, who is Dom DeLuise's son and the brother of the guy who's the bad guy in Encino Man. And then James LaGrosse, who, again, he was the one who I kept staring at his face going, where have I seen this guy before? And I look him up and he's in a bunch of TV shows. And I'm like, I don't know. I don't really watch TV until I finally got far enough down the IMDb. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, I just watched Point Break last week. I can't believe I didn't recognize Roach from Point Break.
Yeah.
But anyway, so let's get into this a little bit. How do we make up a story of our own? That's the thing we do here in Razor Rentals, right? We improv stories or find ways to improve or redo or put our own spin on something. So if we were to try to connect Solar Babies and Prayer of the Roller Boys into something of our own, I think that we have two options, and then we can kind of spitball a little bit. I think one option is we kind of focus on the reason that we looked at these movies in the first place, which is that they're radical extreme sports movies, you know, that for some reason just focus so much on like roller skating. But, you know, there was movies like Gleaming the Cube that we talked about not that long ago, where, you know, the whole movie is based on skateboarding. And there's a bunch of movies from the VHS era that really just leaned into like the extreme sports angle. I have to mention one of my favorite ones, and Justin turned me on to this one as a kid too, is I fucking love Airborne from 1993. Early Jack Black and Seth Green. That movie's fucking great.
I watched Winners Take All the other day.
Yes.
I forgot how good that was.
That's one I haven't seen in a very long time.
Nice. It's like Winner Take All is like this exact same movie as Rad, but it's dirt bikes instead of bicycles.
I will say this real quick, is these movies are directly responsible for one of my favorite movies of the last 20 years, and that's Turbo Kid. It's basically post-apocalyptic, weird sci-fi movie in the future where water is controlled by a madman and, you know, BMX biking is the means of transportation. Like, it's just... It's so ridiculous, but so damn fun.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I definitely did not like put that together. But you're exactly right that there were actually so many of these movies in the 80s and 90s where like extreme sports was combined with a post-apocalyptic future. There were so many of them that they were able to make like a parody movie that was genuinely really good, because they had enough, you know, source material to not only feed on people's nostalgia for that genre, but then say, yeah, okay, let's do it better. You know, like, let's through the lens of the future, like let's fix all the mistakes of these dumb movies and like do something really cool.
And I love that. I love that that exists, that this is such a popular subgenre of action movie that we got like a parody movie of it in the 20 teens.
Yeah, love it. I love it. So what I was saying is we could go the route of just doing our own original story that's inspired by Solar Babies and Prayer of the Roller Boys as a genre, in the way that Turbo Kid is a takeoff, where there's that, you know, again, they're looking at it for inspiration and then telling their own story. So I think that that's one option. Or the other option is that we take these movies and, as Justin mentioned, we do something where it's like, you know, the future of one is the past of the other, you know, where Solar Babies is some kind of a sequel to Roller Boys, and then we find a way to tell a story that bridges the two. Like, how do you get from Prayer of the Roller Boys to Solar Babies in the same universe? Like, what's the story in between?
Yeah, I think that that's the way we should go with this. I really do, because there is enough connective tissue, I think, between the two properties that we could find a way to bridge them together. Like let's look at this like a trilogy, kind of how we did with the Christian Slater movies. Look at this as a trilogy, but the second movie doesn't exist. We have to make it exist. So how do we connect those two movies?
Ooh, I like that. I like the idea of thinking about it as a trilogy too. Sorry to interrupt you, because
that
just makes me think of like storytelling tropes. Like in the second movie is like, you know, the Empire Strikes Back of the trilogy. Like it's going to be the darker one, you know, the one with the drearier ending, the one that doesn't necessarily wrap everything up. So yeah, I really like that.
Yeah, and I feel like it's going to have to be a little fucked up, because if you look at the world that Prayer of the Roller Boys takes place in, like, it could have just been like 1990s LA with more graffiti and more crime. You know, like it had the look of just 1990s LA. Like it was, you know, the same kind of like world design that we were living in. You know, they just threw some tents on the street and they were like, yeah, it's the future.
Like, yeah, Prayer of the Roller Boys to me feels like it only takes place maybe 30 years in the future. It's not as definitely future as Solar Babies is, where that could be easily a couple hundred years in the future. But yeah, I do like the idea of, you know, making it a trilogy and we write the second movie. that makes sense. I think that's a better way of trying to just directly connect the two. And maybe the second movie ends with, you know, we were talking about Bodhi, like Bodhi's first appearance on Earth or something like that. Maybe it, maybe the final climax of that second movie doesn't end on a happy note. You know, maybe it ends on a sad note where Bodhi just disappears.
Right.
But yeah, Mike, so you were saying, you started jumping in thinking about if it was a trilogy. So let me toss the ball back to you. Did you have an idea of where we would start with something like this? I mean, do you think it's just a natural progression from Roller Boys, then we can kind of extrapolate where the world goes, or was there something else you were thinking of?
No, I think we could just kind of extrapolate from, because at the end of Per the Roller Boys, we see very clearly that Gary Lee, we see, like, yeah, he's behind bars, but he's still kind of controlling things, and clearly has the money and power to not have to worry about being incarcerated. So I feel like his organization, his group has gained enough power and momentum that it would continue going. And I feel like the next logical step for a group like that would be some kind of control. Not just like, oh, we're a street gang controlling a city, but like an actual, like, I don't want to say a world power yet, but an actual power that's controlling part of the country. And I feel like that would continue to build until they are a world power, which would then be a problem for other countries considering their ideologies. So where I'm thinking is that Gary Lee's world leads to, like, basically World War III. Like some kind of nuclear event or something that would turn the world that we see in Prayer of the Roller Boys into the wasteland that we see in Solar Babies. And again, do we even know if Solar Babies takes place in the US?
I'm glad you asked that, because we mentioned Mad Max, and I was thinking about that the entire time watching Solar Babies, like listening for clues, because right from the beginning, I was thinking, you know, this is in Australia or something. It turns out they actually filmed it in Spain. But yeah, it looks exactly like Beyond Thunderdome. So the short answer is no, we don't know where it takes place. It could easily take place in Australia. You know, Justin, you mentioned we don't see the rest of society. We don't see big cities. We don't see skyscrapers in the distance anywhere. And when you think about the geography of Australia, part of why those movies worked, the sequels where you had these vast wastelands, is because so much of Australia is the outback. There's only like 9 cities and they're all on the coast.
Right.
The other idea I had to kind of explain the Solar Babies world is maybe Gary Lee, when he got out of prison, actually instigated the Day of the Rope, and he ended up killing off like maybe 75% of the human race, you know, like, you know, just saving the ones that he wanted. And then the people who didn't take the rope ended up surviving, like the origins of the Chicani, for example, and other people that might be around. So that's another way of doing it, where it's not an apocalyptic event like a World War III, where it's like nuclear bombs. Maybe the World War III was the Day of the Rope on a world scale. And that he actually, you know, maybe not Gary Lee specifically, but maybe like Gary Lee's descendants actually pulled it off. And that led to the fact that they could take control, because all, you know, there's no more people, because, you know, the next generation didn't exist because he killed them off.
Yeah,
I think that's a much more grim way of looking at it. And because of that, there's just less people. So it could still, it could happen. It could be in the U.S. Like, they could be in Arizona somewhere, or, you know, like in Nevada or something like that. We don't even know. Like, they could be outside of California. Like, if you want to connect it even more with Prayer of the Roller Boys, they could still be on the West Coast of the United States. We just don't know, like, because they control the water, the ocean's all drained up. So they could still be in LA. But again, it's just the thought that I had, instead of going with the normal nuclear war kind of concept, because we do need a way to get rid of a bunch of people. Mm-hmm. And playing directly with Prayer of the Roller Boys, that would make the most sense. And it's a way that he could end up controlling, you know, getting control of different governments in different countries, or, like, you know, maybe not Gary specifically, but like the people that followed him afterward, you know, could gain control and eventually become the protectorate that we see in Solar Babies.
Okay. Okay, I like what you did there. I like this concept of playing with the whole gene manipulation that he was forcing, that the whole sterilization and Prayer of the Roller Boys. Okay, so what if let's go with that. So he does continue this thing. Now, keep in mind, the whole Day of the Rope idea was he was weeding out the weak by putting the drugs out there, and those that take the drugs end up becoming sterile. So you have to take the drug in order to become sterile. What if he starts, like, his people start implementing that, in the sense of, like, okay, we're gaining control, but, you know, we're separating society into the untouchables, the people who they don't want to carry on and have, you know, progeny. And then we have the ones that are on our side, the ones we deem worthy. And what if they're implementing that whatever the additive he was putting in the drug that was the Day of the Rope, like, what if that additive they start putting into food and resources that they're giving out to the people that they control, so they're ensuring that the weak will not survive into the next generation? So they're already creating their own downfall by destroying parts of society. Like, they're killing off the future. So that continues. What if they continue to gain power, right? And that's gonna basically, America would become the new big bad, like how Nazi Germany was in the 40s. You know, it's the U.S. would be, holy shit, like, look what they're doing. And then have other countries try to stop us. But the funny thing is, we could actually have Solar Babies take place in Australia if we wanted to, because it could be like, we could like bridge the gap where it's, do you remember what happened, like what America did that started the downfall of the world type of thing? Like, they could be over in Australia in just living in this horrible wasteland that was created because of the wars that were started because of Gary Lee's people.
Yeah. Okay. So I love this. Yeah. I got some light bulbs going off too. I think the way that we have the Roller Boys evolve from a street gang into an actual, like, political power or a corporate entity with enough clout and influence in society is we have them take over legitimate businesses. Now, think about the future that they explain in Prayer of the Roller Boys. They don't go into a lot of details of what the economic downturn was, but they mention a crash. You know, the opening monologue from Gary Lee talks about how our parents were borrowing too much money. There was this huge crash. So it's kind of like, you know, the Great Depression times whatever. Like, it's the worst economic depression in history, that the government started to crumble. They never go into specific detail, but they talk about how, you know, other nations were coming in and, like, buying up so much of America that America, like, barely existed anymore. And I never really took that to mean that there wasn't a United States anymore, but that, you know, all of the government or all of the businesses, all of the real estate, all the land, all everything was owned by foreign businesses, you know, like the, Japanese that we see in one scene in the movie. And combine that with the fact that we know that Griffin and his family at one point lived in these homeless camps. Even Gary Lee mentions it. He came up with Bullwinkle in the homeless camps, right? So these people who, it's like a debtor's prison for these people who were victims of the Depression, and now they're living like cattle in these pens. Somebody is keeping them in there. And so there's got to be some kind of an economic, you know, or a capitalistic opportunity where some company is running those camps, right? So then take that to Gary Lee decides, my plan to get lowlives hooked on drugs and have my drugs sterilize them to prevent the next generation, like, that was foiled by Griffin and the police. So instead, I'm just going to buy up the company that runs the debtors camps. And now I have millions of people, like, living in essentially prisons that I own, where I control their food, their water, and absolutely everything. And by doing that, the Roller Boys would, they just rebrand. We just do it right here in the early days, like within years of the end of the Prayer of the Roller Boys movie. The Roller Boys, having been disgraced by Gary Lee's arrest and the downfall of the drug empire, they rebrand. They call themselves the Protectorate. The Protectorate is, oh no, we're here to protect you. We're going to buy up all the, we're going to buy up all these debtors camps from these horrible, evil corporate businesses that are just trying to make a buck, and we're going to give it back to the people. Look at all the food and water and clothes, and look how good we're going to treat everybody. And yeah, they're still in the camp, but we're going to help them get out of there. We're going to find them jobs, and they're going to spin this story and make everybody love them. The Protectorate are going to come in to save the day while secretly poisoning all of these people who are in their camps. And I think that that's how we give them the power. And it starts off with the same financial power that these foreign investors had by coming in to take over America. And then now Gary Lee is going to do what he said. He's going to buy America back. And he's going to do that with a legitimate business.
I like that. I like that a lot. That feels like the next logical step in his evolution.
And I also, if you want to connect it with Prayer of the Roller Boys even more, maybe Griff keeps monitoring Gary, like he keeps an eye on him to see what's going on. And maybe eventually, once he realizes that Gary's done, you know, that Gary's behind the Protectorate, that maybe he is the genesis of the Eco Warriors. Or maybe Milty is the genesis of the Eco Warriors. You know,
yeah,
because
it
Milty,
should be Milty.
Yeah, because Milty was like the one most affected by Gary, and that maybe Milty becomes the, you know, once he's grown up, like, you know, both him and Griff have been following it, but they're like realizing that there's no way for them to necessarily take down Gary because he's gotten so big because of the Protectorate, that maybe that, you know, Milty decides, hey, that maybe there's a different way he could go about doing it. And he starts the, you know, the Eco Warriors or, you know, the precursor to what the Eco Warriors could be, because maybe it was something else or whatever. But that could be where they come from. And with everything happening with the sterilization, people start, you know, dying off. And again, that's where the Eco Warriors start really kind of building up, because they're like, they're realizing something's wrong. You know, like something's really messed up, and they're trying to figure out where it's coming from, because they don't think necessarily it's the Protectorate, even though Milty knows that there was that stuff. But maybe, you know, he's just not sure, but he's thinking that they're behind it. And that's an easy way of doing it, where it's not pushing it so far, but the society has gotten so messed up from not having enough people that a major downturn starts. And again, if the Protectorate's already controlling all the food and water that goes into these camps, what does it mean that they can't control more and eventually become the ones that control the water, you know, over time? But
yeah,
so.
I think that's all great. I think what we should focus on here, if we're going to get into like, hey, let's tell like a beginning, middle, and end story, I think that the focus definitely needs to be on Milty's generation, right? Milton now, he's got to be grown up, and he's got to be, you know, like a grizzled figure who's had some experience in like the eco wars of the past couple of decades, right? I don't really think it matters how much time passes between this story and Solar Babies. But yeah, I think the focus here is, you know, we start off and it's the height of the Eco Wars. Like, we just jump right into the middle of the action and kind of fill in the backstory. And here the Eco Wars are Gary Lee or the Protectorate's organization. And because they're this huge corporation, they make all their money off of commodity control, right? Controlling the food and everything that comes out of these camps. And they don't give a shit about the environment. They're not eco-friendly. They're not being green. You know, like, they don't care, right? And this is a horrible society. The economy sucks. So they're not worried about, you know, how carbon neutral their fucking oil tankers are. You know, like, I think what Milton does is, because you have to sort of fight this war against this huge corporation, that's the angle that Milty takes. The angle is not, we're going to fight this street gang because they're criminals. It's like, these are legitimate businessmen. How do you fight legitimate businessmen? Well, you become like eco-terrorists or eco-activists is a better word, right? So that's exactly what they do. It's like they're protest. It starts off with protesting, and then it leads to actively engaging in, you know, skirmishes with the Protectorate. And by the time the story starts, you have the Eco Warriors, who have now become the criminal gang, the underground outlaw element who are trying to take down the Protectorate because they see how evil it is. Milty knows what the real story is, but he's selling it to his whole army by talking to them about how they're going to save the Earth. And I think, see, that's the connection to the theme of Solar Babies. The theme of Solar Babies mm-hmm. is that we have destroyed the Earth. How do we save it? So we yeah. have to destroy. We have to destroy the Earth first. And that's, I think, right. that's what the focus of this second story is. Is, you know, it's the focus on Milton trying to prevent the Protectorate from destroying the Earth. But his secret motivation is that he knows that Gary Lee's a fucking snake.
Right. And I feel like, you know, I know we talked about maybe not doing the nuclear thing, but there has to be some kind of event that is going to stop the rain. Because keep in mind, there's no rain in Solar mm-hmm. Babies like that, like to the point where like these kids grew up hearing about thunderstorms and rainstorms as if it was fiction. So yep. that means that nothing has rained for years. And I feel like a nuclear fallout would end up kind of leading to some of that. Like it would burn out oceans, you know, it would burn mm-hmm. out waterways, you know, and then like the eventual fallout. Yeah. There would be acid rain and stuff, which would destroy part of the land, like especially any kind of, you know, crop land that we would have. And eventually everything would dry out. So I feel like that we got to have some kind of cataclysmic event that could lead to Solar Babies, but also we have to figure out a time when Bodhi shows up. So mm-hmm. the, you know, maybe it's after whatever that cataclysmic event is, where people are still fighting amongst themselves, like for the scraps that are left behind. And then here comes, you know, spherical alien Jesus, you know, trying to help. And, you know, because we're humans and we suck, it's just like, this thing wants to help, kill it, use its power, you know?
Yeah.
And so, of course, it goes into hiding.
Yeah. So my knee-jerk reaction to that is, yes, nuclear war is the ending. It's the ending that we get to, and I'm sure there's a better example, but I'm thinking of a movie like Fight Club, where they're trying to stop what the Project Mayhem gang is doing, but then they win at the end. They win. They blow up all those buildings in, like, the credit district or whatever the hell it is, right? Like, mm-hmm. they get away with it. And I think that is where the movie should end. And I think if you're watching this as a trilogy, having never seen Solar Babies, if you watch Prayer of the Roller Boys and then it escalates into this second movie and it turns from this battle over the environment and over resources and it transforms into a nuclear standoff that, holy shit, the Protectorate wins. Like, they launched the nukes. And again, you know, by the end of the movie, Bodhi is gone. Our heroes are dead. All has been lost. But there's a third story. And in that third story, we find out, like, what happened. Now it's, you know, obviously they're living in this, you know, apocalyptic wasteland. And Bodhi comes back to save the day. So I think that's where we need to get to. Like, what happens between where we start with the Eco Wars to the nukes fall? I think that is the way we go. So, because I don't want to just like paint this with a wide brush, let's slow down a little bit, kind of knowing where we're going, and tell the story of, you know, Milton and the Eco Warriors, and how does Bodhi come into it? You know, how does Space Jesus show up? And like, is there a character that we can focus on? Is it Milty or is it somebody else?
I feel like Milty is it. I feel like he should be the, like Justin said, like the founder of the Eco Warriors, and like kick all of that off, because he knows about Gary Lee. He knows about the Roller Boys. He fell for their bullshit, you know, and then he almost, you know, was sterilized himself because of it, because he fell into using the mist, because he fell into that. So he knows about how fucking evil this guy is. So I feel like he would kick this, like he would be the focal point. He would be the guy that we would be watching throughout this. But yeah, like we need to give him some other characters, like, you know, some sidekicks, some people who would back him up.
Yeah. So I'm immediately thinking of him as like a family man, right? He had an older brother that he was close with. He had a family with Speedbagger and Patricia Arquette, whatever her character's name was. I can't remember.
Casey.
So let's let's do something where we set up very much like Lucas Haas, who was deaf in Solar Babies, right? Daniel was deaf. And so we immediately get to see what Bodai does, because Bodai can heal Daniel. Like, I think we kind of need to do something like that here, where let's set up a situation where Milty's like a family man living in hiding somewhere. And, you know, somebody in his unit, his kid, his somebody else who's in his camp or his bunker, whatever, like there's a character like a Daniel where we can immediately have them encounter Bodai and like, oh my God, I can walk, or, you know, whatever.
Right. Okay. So, well, first and foremost, like, so we're gonna jump ahead in the future here. So, Gary Lee, as you mentioned, you know, becomes like, they rebrand, they do all that, they take control. So we're already talking, what, like maybe 20 years after Roller
Boys? I would
Boys?
Say more. I would say go 50. Maybe Milty's like in his, you know, like early 60s, you know, but he's still a very strong dude because he's been through some shit. You know, like, he doesn't have to be a young guy. Like, I think he's our main focal point. But he's got, you know, there's a lot, he's got a lot of young people around him. Like you said, he's got a family that he's had over time. But I like the idea of, you know, it's been a good solid like 50 years since the, you know, events of the first one. Because I think Milty was like 12 or something in the first movie. He was a young dude still. So I like the idea of him being in his early 60s, just kind of like the withered, you know, kind of like John Connor from Terminator. You know, like same, that kind of contact that he's seen some shit. He's been through some shit. He's been fighting the Protectorate. Say he's been fighting Protectorate for like 30 years now. You know, maybe they rebranded like 30 years ago to become the Protectorate, maybe even 40 years ago. And he's been fighting them that long. He's living in hiding, even though, you know, the Equal Warriors have been a thing for a while now. He's in hiding. He's got the family. And maybe one of his kids is kind of like a Lucas Haas character, has some kind of, you know, something happened to him recently. Or, you know, maybe, oh, actually an idea. How about maybe there was an event that happened and that it just went sideways and his kid got injured during the event, and that he's kind of taken a step back because he realized that it's getting too close to his family again, and that he can't. So he's kind of that's the reason he's in hiding, is that he just, you know, one of these, you know, protests, one of these, you know, things going against Protectorate didn't go the way that he wanted, and one of his kids got hurt. And maybe it's not even a young kid, maybe not the same age as like Lucas. Maybe this person is, you know, more of a, you know, like maybe like 18 or something like that, wanted to fight with his father, but something went wrong and maybe he got paralyzed or something like that. I don't know. Just kind
of. You just gave me a shitload of ideas. So, okay, here's the thing. I like the idea of having it 50 years in the future. So let's definitely go with that. But okay. Milty took the drugs. He, you know, and they even said, like, you know, they're like, what's going to happen to Milty? And he's like, he should be okay. There was no guarantee that it would be okay. Right. So what if Milty thinks he's sterile because he had taken this drugs? So he's fighting back, like all his adult years he's fighting back against the Protectorate. He's leading these groups, and again, it's like, you know, throwing stones at a tank. You know, the Protectorate is huge. The Protectorate has a lot of power and money and weapons, and these guys are like this little band of freedom fighters that are trying to fight back, but with very small victories here and there. Like, you know, Milty is maybe he's running like the idea of the Eco Warriors in the early days. Maybe he's like created like these safe community spaces where they're kind of off the beaten path, where they can grow their own food, take care of their own. You know, they're getting water where they can. Maybe they have like some kind of weird irrigation system or filtration system to, like, you know, maybe it's like Water World, where they created a filtration system where it's like, well, we take the urine and we clean it out and get the little water we can from it. But anyway, like, so we have, he's been doing this. He's been fighting, and he doesn't care if he lives or dies. His whole thing, his legacy is going to be stop Gary Lee's ideology, fight against it. His older brother fought against it. Maybe at this point, maybe Griffin's dead at this point, you know, it's years in the future, Griffin's dead. But at some point in his adult years, like maybe in like his 40s, he has a kid, and he didn't expect that he could have a kid. And that whole thing of like, holy shit, I have a child. I have to protect them. So he kind of goes into hiding. And, you know, the eco warriors, because remember, when we find the eco warriors, they're hiding. So he he brings like the people into hiding because he doesn't want his son to constantly be faced with life and death situations the way he spent his life doing. So, you know, we fast forward to his son is, you know, 18 years old, 20 years old, whatever. He doesn't want to hide out anymore. He wants to fight back, you know, and his dad's like, no, don't do it. You know, like, I don't want you to die. Like, you know, I never thought I could have you, that type of thing. Like, I never thought I would have a son. Like, I want you to be safe. Maybe that kid has some kind of defect. Like, maybe he's like blind in one eye, or, you know, he's deaf or something. Maybe we could even take the thing from Daniel. He's deaf. Yeah. And this is the character that ends up finding Bodhi or meeting Bodhi and is healed, which forces Milty and his people to be like, you know what, we have to fight back. Like, we have this power that we can use. So they try to fight back and they fucking fail. And that's what leads to Solar Babies.
Works for okay. me.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that works out great. So let's slow down and put some details in here now. So to your point, you know, Milton's older. Griffin is dead. Let's have it that like Gary Lee is dead at this point too. And you know, they tell some famous story about how he, you know, died in like the Battle of Seattle or whatever. And now the Protectorate, they have all their propaganda posters are these like, you know, Soviet era posters of Gary Lee that look like Stalin, you know, and yes, it's like, yes. And he's become this like bigger than life figure for them. And the current leader of the Protectorate is, you know, maybe like Gary has become a title, like, you know, it was Gary Lee, like his name was Lee. So now it's like the current guy is called the Gary, you know?
Right.
And like, maybe we don't even end up finding out what his real name is. It doesn't matter, because he's just the Gary who's in charge of the Protectorate. And yeah, to your point, Milton's got a son. He had a son late in life. His son's name is Jason. I'm just going to take the names of the actors from Solar Babies, right? So his son's name is Jason. I got to say, I don't love the idea of having him also be deaf, because it does immediately repeat that that healing scene from Solar Babies at the beginning of the movie. But I like the idea, like I said it before myself, that we need to demonstrate Bodhi's healing power. But I also really like this idea that Milton thought he was sterile, has a kid, but his kid ends up with a birth defect. That tracks with the fact that he had whatever that rope compound was in him. So, you know, he never had any other kids after that. Jason was his miracle kid. He wants to protect Jason. He's always wanted to protect Jason. Jason, you can't go to battle with me. Like, you know, I'm going to give up the fight so I can keep you safe, you and your family. And, you know, but maybe Jason just has like a, you know, like a bum arm. Like, he's, you know, he's got an arm that just hangs. It doesn't really work. Something where, yeah, he can encounter Bodhi, and so that when he immediately, when he picks up Bodhi, it's like, oh fuck, like I can move both my arms, and you in the same way that we saw that Daniel could hear, and, you know, very quickly send the message. So I definitely want to talk about like, how does Bodhi show up? I think we need to come up with that. But where I'm going with this is, you know, to your point, Justin, Jason has this story arc where he's like, you know, I don't need to live your life, Dad. Like, I'm going to go out and fight the Protectorate. Like, you know, you've kept me, you know, hidden and protected my whole life. You wiped my ass my whole life, and I need to get out there and like do my part, you know? And there's like other families living in this like bunker with them. And one of the families, you know, Jason has fallen in love with this girl, right? We'll call her Jamie. Jason has fallen in love with Jamie. And, you know, Jamie is, she's another kind of like miracle child as well. Like, she's not white, and, you know, she's from a family of people of color who, again, very much like Jason, they're like, you know, we have to protect our baby. That's why, you know, we stay in this bunker with the rest of our families. Like, everybody in here is a miracle child, because this generation should not exist.
Right.
And I think it would be nice just to have this love story. And of course, you know, Jamie and Jason, they don't ever think that they can have kids. You know, to them, their love is just, it's ideal. It's a dream. Like, their generations are going to end with them, you know, which is also kind of why Jason is just like, well, fuck it. I'm going to go out, guns blazing, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that's kind of how we set up. And I have an idea for something I want to do with this Jamie character a little bit later. So I think now we need to stop and find out, how does Bodhi show up? How does Space Jesus descend to the earth?
I have an idea for this one. How about the first battle that, so say, you know, again, Jason's been trying to, you know, go into a battle. Maybe there's a skirmish that he hears about. Like, you know, his dad is still technically the leader of the Eco-Warriors, but he's not really running things that, you know, his generals and other people are doing it. Maybe Jason catches wind of a mission they're going to do. And he goes to this mission and, you know, it just turns out into all out kind of assault on both ends, you know, from their protectorate and the Eco-Warriors. And there's, you know, missiles and guns and all kinds of shit flying back and forth. And maybe in one of those scenes, you see like, you know, the street coming from the sky, you know, kind of like, you know, in Solar Babies when they first show the air quote image of Bodhi in the opening credits. But maybe there's a thing that comes down and Jason sees it. And in the process, maybe again, his bum arm kind of bites him in the ass and he gets wounded. So maybe it's not the arm that necessarily is the thing that, you know, kind of leads to the healing. Maybe he gets wounded additionally in the process. And as he's trying to like get out of the battle and trying to figure out what the fuck just fell to the sky, you know, from the sky, that's when he comes across Bodhi. Maybe it's like in an old mall or some shit like that. And you know, he sees it, comes across it, he touches it, and then, you know, his wound heals, and then all of a sudden he can start moving his fingers and the one arm that, you know, he's never been able to move. You know, like, that's a way that they can meet. It just meets in happenstance in battle. Kind of like, again, like, Daniel just meets Bodhi happenstance and, you know, trying to escape from, you know, the E-cops, you know, in the Solar Base.
I like it, but I want to change one thing only because, like, if Jason is constantly being told to, like, stay back, stay out of it, stay out of the fight, and he has a bum arm, like, his dad, of course, is going to be like, you know, dude, stay out of it. Like, you're going to get killed. You can't even hold a rifle, like that type of thing. So what if Jason is like, he's the guy that hangs back, kind of watches over the young ones, watches over, you know, like the infirm, all that, while the Eco-Warriors are doing like strike runs on the Protectorate. So he's basically kind of monitoring the situation, sitting back, like wanting to fight, wanting to get out there and prove himself. And then one of their, because remember they have like we were talking about the crops and the irrigation system and all that. They would have to keep that shit hidden. Like, the Protectorate would obviously be trying to, like, destroy it if they knew about it. So I like the idea. You had mentioned an old mall, and I immediately pictured how a lot of those old malls have those huge skylights. Like, I could see the you know, Jason and the, like, the Eco-Warriors creating some kind of, like, indoor mini farm, like, under one of those skylights and kind of, like, hiding it from view. So it's like it's an indoor farm there. But what if, like, so he's monitoring situation and we see something crash into the building where their fucking food is, and it's like, and he's like, oh god, no, they found us. So knowing, like, his dad and whoever else are, like, off, like, trying to do this strike run and get them supplies, and he's the only one there that saw this happen, so he goes off on his own. He goes to find out, like, what happened to our crops, like, you know, is the Protectorate bombing us, what's going on? And instead he finds, like, you know, maybe there's like a hole in the ceiling, there's some crumbling rocks and whatnot, and there's this glowing orb in, like, the old dried out water fountain in the mall, and he goes to, like, touch it, and when he touches it, like, that glow that Bodhi would glow, you know, put pass between the people, that glow goes over him, and we see, like, maybe his hand, like, he flexes his hand for the first time, and it's, like, all crippled up beforehand, and he just kind of flexes it out, and he's like, and he holds it up in front of his face, like, oh my god, I can move my hand, like, just that moment of realization that whatever this thing is just healed him. So now he's like, I have a miracle cure. I have to share this with dad and the others, you know, grabs Bodhi, brings him back to the encampment. And maybe at that point, you know, Dad and like Jason and the others are, or not Jason, I'm sorry, Milty and the others are getting back, and like they've sustained like heavy injuries. Maybe they've lost a lot of people, and or maybe some shit went down while Jason was out, and it's like, you know, what the fuck were you doing? Like, you know, that like people have been hurt type of thing. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to show like, look, I found this miracle cure, but nobody wants to listen to him because they've taken so much of a loss during this time frame. So now he has to still prove himself like, you know, no, I'm not lying. I'm not. This isn't the flight of fancy. This isn't a kid's story. Like, I know, you know, you look at me like I'm a child, but I found this thing that could help us. Like that whole, we could have the whole, you know, dad versus son, like father knows best scenario that we see in these type of stories all the time, where the kid is disregarded because he's a kid.
Yeah. Okay. This is great. I love this. I was having a very similar idea, so I'm glad you went there. I want to jump in and like change just one thing, but like,
yeah, go for it.
On the same path. So yeah, I like this idea you said before, where they're sort of like living in this old mall and or in this plaza complex. Like they have, some of it is like their little farm, like you said. Bodhi crashes into it, this big, you know, spectacle of light. So Jason, who's left behind to like take care of the young and the infirm and the old or whatever, the non-fighters. So he leaves to go over to this other area or this other part of the complex to investigate the crash at their farm. And he's so like, I don't know, entranced, or maybe he's just scared because he thinks like they're being attacked by the Protectorate, that he just makes a run for it. And like he like leaves a door open to the point where he goes in to this farm. He experiences Bodhi. He's like, oh my God, this heal. And then we have this really cool scene where like the music swells and the camera spins and we see all the food that was in there, and it's just getting bigger and bigger and growing. And it's like, oh my God, it's like this miracle thing. Like, look at all the food in my hand. And so when he runs back out to be like, hey, everyone, look what I found. He finds that in like the parking lot area, like some of these like kids that he was supposed to be taking care of, they had like wandered out after him. Like, hey, Jason, where are you going? And fucking like Protectorate troops like pick him up. And
I love it.
And then they like raid at least part of the complex. And then there's like a fight inside with like, you know, the old veterans and stuff. But now like their cover is blown and the Protectorate, it takes off. Like they, you know, quote unquote, arrest, you know, people that they find in there. So they take off with some of the kids, including Jamie, Jason's girl. And
perfect.
So then when, you know, when Milty gets back. And we have to have some story before this where, because Milton is like the old retired guy, maybe he would normally have been like the head of taking care of those that stayed behind. But for some reason on this mission, he had to go. Like some other leader had gotten killed or captured, where he had to make the hard choice. Like, okay, Jason, you're old enough now. Like, I'm going to go on this mission. You stay behind and protect everybody. Jason fucks it up on his first day. Of course, when Milton comes back and he's just like, I knew it. I knew you weren't ready for this. Like totally feeling betrayed by Jason's fuck up. And now they have to like get their people back. So when Jason's trying to tell him like, look at this thing I found, Milton's like, I don't fucking care. Like you are a complete disgrace and a disappointment to me. And like, they don't want to listen because, not because they're, you know, stupid or they don't believe in it, but like they're so angry with Jason that like, they just don't want to hear anything he has to say. His flight of fancy is bullshit to them. And because they're so angry. But then of course, now we have this drama where, you know, they have to, or they want to go on a mission to go and like rescue the people, or it creates this divide where Milton is like, that's it. The people are gone. We have to stay here and protect who's left. And then, you know, Jason and some of the other people are like, what are you talking about? We have to go rescue our people. To the point where Jason ends up like sneaking out in the same way that the Solar Babies did. He ends up sneaking out with like a small group of like, you know, young hotheads like him who are like, you know, let's go take down the man. So at the risk of like running on and on, I just want to throw this out here too. Like kind of where I was going is the big picture. We can stop mm-hmm. and like fill it in. But I'm thinking like, how do we go from this small Protectorate like raid to nuclear war? And so what I'm thinking, and what makes sense as a larger story arc, is all the while this is happening, we're hearing news stories and like rumors of yeah, an invasion. Like, they're, you know, like the Japanese are going to invade. The Japanese, who in our lifetimes haven't had a standing army since World War II, but right. Now, because it's 50 years in the future and they've bought up half the world, like, the Japanese are an empire again, and they're invading. And so the protectorate has been, like, distracted because they're about ready to dive into this battle, because the protectorate essentially runs the U.S. right now. Like, the U.S. government is like a puppet state, you know. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's part of why the protectorate were there, because they're rounding up conscripts for the army, you know.
That makes a lot of sense, actually, because like, if you look at how the Roller Boys formed in the first place, that makes perfect sense that they'd be taking people by force and basically forcing them to fight in their military services. But no, I really like that idea of Japan invading, because that's not at all where I was going. And that I think that that's a much more interesting idea. So yeah, no, let's go with that. So the idea of the protectorate is fighting a war on two fronts. They're still vying for control. Like, they've mostly control the United States. Like you said, like the government is a puppet state for them. But they're vying for control, but they still have these little pocket groups that maybe they're not calling themselves the Eco Warriors yet. You know, they're just like these little pocket groups of resistance that don't want anything to do with the Protectorate. But the Protectorate wants supreme loyalty. They want loyalty of all their citizens. So, because keep in mind, that's the other thing that, remember, Gary Lee kept saying, like, they're loyal to me. They believe, like, he was very big on making sure everyone was loyal. So that's like, that's going to be one of their, like, their big tenets is that, you know, we take care of you, but you work for us. Like, you take care of us, that whole thing.
Sorry. Just to jump in real quick, I was thinking about, like, the propaganda posters, like the Stalin propaganda posters, or it makes me think of, like, 1984, right?
Oh, yeah.
And they have these, like, slogans. And so I'm picturing the slogans under, like, this silhouette image of Gary Lee's head. You'd have one poster that says, like, purity, and one that says loyalty, you know, and what I can't think what the third one would be, but, you know, like, I'm just picturing, like, that's what you unity see everywhere. Yeah. There you go. That's perfect. Yeah. Good.
No, I fucking love that, dude. Like, that is 100% like the world I was picturing this taking place in. So I love that you brought that up, but yeah, so that's, they're pushing this propaganda hard. Like, they've drank their own Kool-Aid. They believe that they're the saviors, that they're the, like, you know, they think they're the hero of the story, and that they're really helping Americans. Like, they're giving them food and water and a purpose in life. And in reality, they're just fucking enslaving people. I like the idea of them fighting this war on two fronts. Like, they know there's rumor of the Japanese invasion. Maybe the Protectorate knows that they're not as powerful as they want to be, but they do control the U.S. military's weaponry. You know, maybe, like, there's not as much, because remember, the U.S. has been dismantled and sold off, mostly, as we see in Prayer of the Roller Boys. Okay. So our wealth has been drained away from our country. They're basically, they're like a chihuahua. They're barking a lot, but they don't got the might to back it up. But they have a couple of nukes. They do have some means of fighting back, but it's like the final solution type of thing, you know? I really like the idea of Japan invading. I almost want to do a whole movie about that.
Right. That'd be fun. So again, at the risk of, like, you know, blowing the load too early, again, just so we're kind of on the same page, where I was going with that is, again, we have to lead to nuclear war and the bad guys have to win. In this case, the bad guys are the Protectorate, right? So what I'm picking, and I almost want it to be Jason's fault, like, God damn it, Jason, you know, to the right. Point where, like, again, this battle on two fronts. And on one front, you have the Protectorate, you know, battling against the Japanese invasion, but also, like, trying to negotiate with them at the same time. Like, the Gary is distracted, which allows, like, Jason and his little ragtag crew to break into some facility somewhere where they're holding all the conscripts that they've grabbed for the army so they can bust out their people. And, like, you know, there has to be some sort of domino effect of, like, you know, they rescue the people, and then they're like, oh shit, we got to get out of here. Let's fight these guys and fight those guys. And where are we going? And oh no, now we're in the fucking HQ. How did we get here? Shit, like, go that way. And like, the sort of domino effect of like, Gary is so convinced that the Japanese have like invaded his headquarters and like broken his front lines that he's just like, fucking hit the red button, nuke him, fuck him, and like starts global thermonuclear war because Jason and his boys, like, you know, accidentally broke into the headquarters.
Oops.
I just love the drama of that, you know what I mean? And like, we sort of end the movie with like, you know, the screen goes white. But of course, we need to do something with Bodai and the team before we get to that point.
Right. So we have the whole thing where we, you know, we had mentioned Bodai comes down, Jason finds him, but there's also the Protectorate picking up people. And so Jason is going to be kind of, not, I don't want to say shunned, but like, you know, his dad is really disappointed in him type of thing. Mm-hmm. Like, somehow that hurts worse than being punished. You know, so he's kind of, you know, milling about, like, not only did he, you know, get his love interest captured because of his, I don't want to say like excitement, but, you know, wanting to know what the fuck that thing was. And he kind of abandons his duties. And because of that, he ends up, you know, losing a bunch of people that he cares about. So now, of course, he's going to want to break in, as you said, to get what was her name? I'm sorry. What did you name the love interest?
Jamie.
So he's got to break into the facility to get Jamie and the others back. So I feel like that's going to be the focal point of the story, is what is this like rebel run where they're trying to like break into the Protectorate's holding camp and get back their people. So we're going to have some people with Jason. So like, maybe he's got some ragtag friends, you know, like proto solar babies.
yeah, exactly.
So he's got a couple of friends. I don't know what we want to call them, but you know, they're going to end up trying to break into the Protectorate's holding camp and get the others out. And that's going to eventually lead to, you know, Gary Lee's people pushing the red button, like you said. Yeah. So what's the story there? Like, and why are they on roller skates?
Exactly. Right. Cause they gotta be on roller skates. Right. Well, right. I think the roller skates isn't so much like, you know, the point, but obviously, and as an extension of the roller boys, now it's like everybody's on rollerblades. Like, everyone uses rollerblades all the time. You know, right. I think to Justin's point earlier, like, why do they wear roller skates, like the four-wheel traditional skates in Solar Babies? And to that, I would just say, like, you know, that's just what they had, man. You know, or they just don't really remember it in great detail because it's like far enough in the future that they get like details wrong. But yeah, no, they obviously have to be skating, and there has to be some advancement at this point. Like, somebody's got to have like rocket blades, you know what I mean?
Right.
Or somebody's got like a, you know, like a souped up skateboard, snowboard kind of a deal where they're like street skating, you know, that sort of thing. Or street skiing. But yeah, so just using the actors from the other movies, like you did with Jason and Jamie, like, we've got Lucas, we've got Peter, we've got Corey, you know, it could just be a handful of people like that, you know, maybe Patricia or Pat. And yeah, I don't know that we necessarily like want to get into all of the individual characters and their personalities, but I think what has to happen with Bodai is, you know, Jason is convinced that he has to like save the day. And he also becomes more and more convinced that Bodai has like come to them, like it's a sign from the heavens, like the key to taking down the Protectorate that we've all like hoped and prayed for is here. Like, look, guys, it needs to be a sort of combination of overconfidence and also like a camaraderie with Bodai. What I mean by overconfidence is Jason is immediately healed, so he's going to feel like invincible. You know, he's going to convince his people like, hey, I made a mistake, but this isn't a mistake. Bodai's going to protect all of us. Like, you know, and maybe he could even demonstrate that, like when he convinces his team to like go and invade, like right off the bat in their first like little skirmish to get into the facility, somebody gets hurt, whether it's a they have like a battle with the Protectorate, somebody gets shot, or even it could just be an accident. Like, you know, they're racing to get into the building and someone takes a fucking tumble and like, you know, breaks their arm or something. And then, oh, but it's okay, I got Bodhi. Bodhi will fix you, you know. And I just kind of like this idea of Jason is, because he's been protected his whole life, he's been held back his whole life, he doesn't know anything about the real world. And he's so like idealistic, but like to a fault where it becomes dangerous to the people around him, you know. So I think it would be, he would have this like confidence that Bodhi could do anything. Bodhi is their secret weapon. And he just buys into it immediately in the same way that Daniel did. And the people around him maybe like don't know what it's about, or maybe even get a little bit scared. Like, what is that thing? That, where does it come from? Why is it so powerful? And I think one of the other characters should start communing with it, but in a more of a friendly way. Like, let's say Peter, right? Maybe Peter's like, Jason, chill. Like, this thing is not here to be your like band-aid. Bodhi's, you know, he came here for a reason. We need to like find out like what his mission is. Like, you know, what has he come to do? But Jason doesn't care. Just like before, when he finds Bodhi, he's very single-minded. I think that's a trait in him that's going to get everybody, literally everybody, in trouble.
Yeah, and he's going to lead to the downfall of the movie. So yeah, no, I like where you're going with that. So yeah, he's going to be using Bodhi as almost like a snake oil salesman, you know, just yeah, like, look what this can do. Watch how I can heal. Maybe to the point like where he's almost getting cocky about it, like, you know, cutting his hand and then holding Bodhi and holding his hand up and showing that his hand is healed, like trying to be like, he can cure everything. He can solve, like, he can save us, like, just, pushing really hard on that. And maybe he's convinced like the whole point of Bodhi is to take down the Protectorate. So like, not only is he going to break in to try to save Jamie and the others, but he's hoping to use Bodhi as a weapon to stop the Protectorate, which of course is going to make Bodhi leave, because remember, Bodhi disappeared.
That's right.
So maybe he's going to leave when he realizes that the humans that he's, you know, with at the moment are, they're hell bent on destruction. They're going to self-destruct, which is where this movie's going to end. So maybe that's why Bodhi leaves.
Yeah, I kind of like that. And again, I kind of want to, I think we can explain that through interaction with these other characters that we're going to add to Jason's group. Like I mentioned, this Peter guy, you know, and maybe what we see is, you know, is Peter, who first really talks to Bodhi at the level that like Daniel did, you know, in a peaceful, understanding way. And then, you know, Corey and Lucas, they feel the same way and they start to have this bond. And, you know, it's like they're convinced that Jason is on the wrong path. And they're like, Jason, like, this is a mistake. Like, you know, Bodhi is here to like save us, but this is not what he came here to do. You got to come with us. And, you know, Jason's kind of fighting against them. Like, no, no, guys, come on. And, you know, they're communicating with Bodhi. Maybe we even see like Bodhi in a similar scene, like in Solar Babies, when you saw all that like energy join their hands together, almost like in a circle. And it's like, maybe Peter is like, look what he's trying to do. He's trying to bring us together and like teach us something. And they start like connecting the light to their hands and the light to their hands. And then when it comes to Jason, and he's just like, no, and he like grabs Bodhi and like runs off. And it's like, he's not getting it because he's so single-minded. Yeah. And I think that there has to come to a point where maybe Peter and Jason, like in this little mini climax, they're arguing and they're fighting, and like Peter grabs the backpack that Bodhi's in and Jason grabs it back and he's like, no man, like this is wrong. And Jason's like, screw you man, I gotta rescue everybody. And they're fighting, and in a similar scene where we saw Bodhi and Solar Babies, he kind of like pops into like this glitter in the air, you know, this like shining little lights. And maybe he does that. We see Bodhi turn into this like orbit of lights and spinning around. And then Peter just goes like, oh no, oh no. And then like you see Bodhi leave. He flies away. Like, okay, I picked the wrong people. I'm going somewhere else. And we don't really even need to explain where he goes or why, because the point is that they had this god and all they could do is fucking argue about it. And I just think that's like the message we need to deliver here, that like they ruined the world themselves.
Yeah.
And also now we have the explanation of how people know who he is or like know about Bodhi. It's Jason spreading the word afterward of this great power, this great thing but it left, and he's the one. How about if Jason's the one that expresses anger towards Bodhi for leaving and all this kind of stuff, and he leads to be the, you know, like the side of people like Strict or Grok that know about Bodhi, know that it's power, but they're so angry that it left that if it ever came back, they would destroy it because he left. Or, you know, something like that. It could be like Jason that leads to that, and it's Peter's side of and his other friends that tell the good side of Bodhi. You know, the ones that, you know, eventually tell the stories to the Chicane, you know, and what the warden, you know, hears over the years, you know, the time. Like, it's that split, it's that fight that kind of deviates the memory of Bodhi into the two different camps that we see in Solar Babies.
Okay. You know, I'm kind of liking where we're going with this, because I didn't expect this to happen, but it's almost like, so, okay, in Prayer of the Roller Boys, you have Griffin, who is reluctantly joins the bad guys to help out his brother. His brother lets, you know, Milty lets Griffin down by buying into the whole Roller Boys ideology and like taking the drugs and selling the drugs, and like he has to prove himself, he has to come back from that. So now Milty in the future is trying to do the right thing constantly, and his son ends up screwing things up for everybody, you know. So it's almost like the Vader story, you know. Yeah. Where it's like he started off good and then became bad, you know. It's like he ended up causing Bodhi to leave and then ends up creating, you know, his own worst enemy by creating that camp of people that are against Bodhi in the future. Mm-hmm. And that are kind of almost reinforcing, like, if you can't beat them, join them, like the Protectorate idea. So yeah. Because the E-Police come out of that. But I have this image in my head that I keep seeing over and over, where like where this movie needs to end. And I'm sorry to like jump to the ending, but like I just keep seeing it, is eventually Jason and his, you know, ragtag group of people who are trying to break into the Protectorate's camp and free his people, it's going to lead to, like you said, Josh, like they're going to basically hit the nukes because they think that the Japanese are invading. Maybe at the same time as Jason and his people are breaking into the Protectorate's holding facility, maybe that's when word comes that, like, you know, the Japanese have invaded American soil. So, like, the powers that be are going to get nervous and, you know, hit the button. But, like, maybe Jason, like, the thing I'm picturing is Jason holding up Bodhi, being like, okay, stop him, like, trying to use Bodhi as a weapon. Yep. And then him doing that thing where he just like disappears and turns into like goes away. And then the button gets pressed. We see the nukes launch and we just see, like, you know, I'm picturing Jason just being like, I'm sorry, Dad. And then boom, like the explode, like he fucked up, you know, like he led to the downfall that his dad fought so hard against.
Yeah, I love that. And that's the perfect way to end it. I think just ending on like the boom, the mushroom cloud, the screen goes white, and then like sad music. Like that's the way you end the movie. But Justin, you brought up a good point just to back up too for a second, which is like how do the stories of Bodhi get to the future, the sphere of Longinus? Like why do Grok and his people hate it? And why do the Chicani leaders, you know, remember it as being something good? Like they revere it almost. And I think that's exactly what you do. We combine these confrontations into, yeah, Jason is like, he breaks into the bridge or whatever, like the control room of this facility where, you know, the Gary or his lieutenant, like, you know, he has like his finger on the nuke and they break in. And just to your point, like Jason's brandishing it like a weapon to the point where these Protectorate guys are like, oh no, they brought this ultimate weapon. Where did they get it from? And like, they're afraid of it without any backstory about what it does. They don't know that it heals. They don't know anything. They just know this kid broke in here with this like glowing laser orb that's about to kill us all. And then Jason and like Peter sort of like fight over it. Peter's trying to stop him. Bodhi disappears right at that scene, like right at that moment, the screen lights up and like the Gary from somewhere else is like, you know, they've invaded, all is lost. So this lieutenant guy like hits the fucking red button. But in that moment of chaos, everybody runs, like Peter runs, the Protectorate guys run. And like, and we don't see necessarily where they go, but they're just hauling ass next to each other, not even fighting anymore, just getting the fuck out of there, because, you know, the implication is that there's like a fallout shelter or there's a bunker, a basement somewhere where they're going to go be protected, while Jason, who is completely shocked that his plan failed and Bodhi is gone, you know, he is just frozen in place in shock, and to your point, it's just like, I'm sorry, Dad, and, you know, blows up with like the rest of the building. So it's the people who had run who end up telling the story, but it's, again, to your point, Justin, it's the people who came with Jason, like Peter and his friends, who knew what Bodhi did, that think of it as a god, and it's the protectorate people who only ever saw it as a weapon who are like afraid of it ever coming back.
Or if it ever came back, they'd want to control it. You know, like make it be their weapon, or, you know, submit it to their will. But yeah.
I dig it.
Yeah. I think this is good. I mean, I think we got it. I mean, I don't know why they call it the Sphere of Longinus, other than maybe in the Solar Baby's future, they've just conflated it with, you know, stories of Jesus and these other legends that came down through history with him. And I think that's probably a good enough explanation. But I think this is a fun little story, and there's not really much more to it. I mean, yeah, we could go through and fill in some of the scenes of what Jason and his group are doing when they break into the Protectorate HQ, and cut away to some of the scenes with the news and with Gary, like negotiating with the Japanese or whatever. But I don't think we need to. I think we've told the story of, you know, the failed savior who comes to try to rescue these people who shoot themselves in the foot because they're human and they make mistakes.
Right. And yeah, I mean, like if we went beat by beat, like, of course we would have the Paul Verhoeven style news segments where we see, like, you know, what's going on in the world and like how fucked up the rest of the world is. And we would see, you know, Japan as the superpower that it's become in this story. You know, and of course we would see like the whole invasion of the camp. Like I don't know why I'm picturing this, but I keep picturing this like almost incline of pavement and like leading down to where the holding cell is, and just Jason and his boys like roller skating down the pavement, like under the cover of night, you know, it's like the spotlights are looking around. And just, you know, they break into the facility and get in there and cause chaos. But yeah, just, you have to have those roller skating scenes. Somebody's got to do a sweet jump and hold their blades.
Yes. And of course, like when they're all like evacuating, you would see people, you know, grabbing their blades and like going down the stair railings and like, you know, using their blades to like escape the building, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, because you're going to make it radical.
Yeah, it's got to be rad.
One thing I would say that we could do potentially is we could do a mid-credit scene where it explains the controlling of water that you get in Solar Babies. So maybe after all the nukes have fired, you know, it comes back, it shows like Japan, and maybe even parts of the, you know, other parts of the world, maybe they shot all the nukes and all the nukes were basically pointed at all their enemies, with Japan being the biggest one. And everything is just on fire. Basically, the whole world's on fire. Maybe that's like a mid-credit scene. And then a post-credit scene doesn't tell you how long it's passed, but there's a scene that comes up that shows a Gary, maybe not the Gary from, you know, the second movie. Maybe it's a Gary that you could tell. It's like, this Gary is maybe two or three down the line. You know, just, I don't know, just like in the way everybody's dressed, something to indicate that and more time has passed. And that he's the Gary that basically gets to the point where he's the one that basically flips the switch and the water's controlled. Like, he's the one that had finally harnessed all the remaining water, and he's the one that actually flips the switch on the aqua bunker, and then that's it. The movie just ends, you know, like at that point. You know, or maybe it ends, it goes to black, and then it says year one, to kind of hearken to the Solar Babies where it's 41. I think that would be kind of cool, like just kind of really tie all three together. And you don't have to even explain that whole time. Like, I like what we did with the second one, but it just kind of gets you to that point where you don't have to explain all those years of people just in pure hell because of the nukes going off. Like, you know what that is. It just tells that one little extra bit. And there you go.
I feel like you could almost do that in like a Dawn of the Dead style credits sequence you have the credits rolling and then you could hear like a news reporter talking about like the fallout in California, blah, 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 you know, and like talk about like the and talk and then show like visuals of burnt out areas and then cut back to the credits and then cut back in and show like, you know, the years passing, like you were saying. And I almost feel like we should show like, you know, the Protectorate is not the Protectorate that it once was. Like it started to become what the E-Police eventually became, where they were basically the only controlling power in that world. But yeah, like you could I like the idea of showing the passage of time through the credits. And then, to your point, like having a post credits like wrap up. That's I think that would be a cool way to do it.
Yeah, I agree. You know, we could even throw something in there about like, you know, Australia opening its borders to immigrants and refugees or whatever, you know, just to just if we wanted to drive that nail home, that Solar Baby's takes place in the same outback as Mad Max. I think that'd be fun.
And, you know, talking about the orphanages opening, you know, to house the thousands of homeless children, you know, in the wake of all the destruction and all that.
It's a good way to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we got there. I mean, this is a weird episode. It was a weird choice, honestly, for, you know, movies to try to mash up. But, you know, as we're going back and looking at the VHS era, there's more of these sort of like quirky subgenres that pop up. And this one being the sort of extreme sports action movies, which, you know, at some point we have to go back and do like a Two Corys episode. I think that would be fun also.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I we did the same thing with our Jay and Silent Bob Meet Frankenstein episode where we kind of thought like, well, what haven't we touched on yet? And, you know, Kevin Smith seemed like an obvious choice and even Christian Slater is sort of a star of the era. So this one's a little bit more of a deep cut, certainly deep cuts in terms of who has actually seen these movies. And I hope, you know, those of you who are still listening enjoy Solar Babies and Pair of the Roller Boys. And if you haven't seen them, go check them out. Go find them. They are both a ton of fun, totally worth your time, you know, and sure, full of roller skating, but they're fun as hell.
And Prayer of the Roller Boys is free on YouTube right now. So if you haven't seen it, go watch it. But I will say, speaking as far as this episode goes, this is something we've done a few times in this series or in this podcast. Like, I know primarily we tend to go through the story and like actually tell a story. But every once in a while, we have to paint in broad strokes because we're trying to connect too many properties or we're trying to tell like a bridging story, like kind of like we did with our Police Academy reboot where we painted in broad strokes. We didn't really tell the full story, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. We did a similar concept with 100% More Christian Slater, where we just kind of told the story of how the movies would bridge together. And I don't know how you would actually release stories like that, maybe as like webisodes, you know, online short films. But for us, it's just a fun exercise to mix things up and do things a little bit differently. We talked about doing that in our year in rear view episode at the end of season two, that going into season three, we wanted to try some new things. You know, we've done a lot of horror movie, you know, versions of like popular 80s movies. And, you know, we've done, I don't want to say we've tread the same ground, but I feel like I don't want to be comfortable just doing the same things over and over again. There are things that come easy. So doing an episode like this is a challenge. This is take two kind of weird, obscure movies that on the surface, they seem so similar that of course they would fit together. But then the challenge is, but how? You know, like what is it exactly? We had the same challenge when we mashed up True Lies and Kindergarten Cop. We talked about that too, also in our year-end special, where it seemed like such an obvious idea on the surface because the characters are so similar. But then when it came time to add something to those franchises ourselves, we weren't sure what to do. And we eventually got to a good story, but we were kind of spinning our wheels for a little while because when things are so similar, I mean, what do you add? Like the same thing? Like finding something new to add in was the challenge. And I think here we kind of landed on it early in terms of how do we add to this story by making it a trilogy and kind of knowing that we wanted to have that darker entry. And then it was just a matter of trying to figure out like what we hang the story on, like what's the heart of the story. But I think we got there.
Yeah. And I mean, sometimes all you need is the beats, Like, you don't need the minutia. You just want to know the broad strokes.
Yeah, absolutely. So. Yeah. Sometimes that's the fun part. And, you know, we're going to be doing some more of that this season, too. We have some other topic ideas for things coming up that we want to do that'll be a little bit more experimental. So, yeah, we'll do some really in-depth stories, and then we'll do some where we're just going to have, like, a lightning round and, you know, just go through and hit the big strokes. But we'll get to those. But for now, I appreciate everyone for tuning into the Raised by Rentals program. You can find out more about us online at raisedbyrentals.com or at Raised by Rentals on the socials that matter. We also belong to the Rad Pantheon, a super team up of podcasters, artists, musicians, all sorts of creative people, creative friends supporting each other and helping to spread the word about rad stuff. So you should check out radpantheon.com and at Rad Pantheon on the social media to check out some more of those projects. Justin, since you're our guest and you're a member of the Rad Pantheon as well, is there anything you'd like to plug?
Yeah, I make music. JustinVonStrasburg.bandcamp.com, or you can just go to JustinVonStrasburg.com. I'm Justin Go Boom on social stuff. I mostly do stuff on Instagram where I drink a shit ton of tea and post about it. So yeah, if you're a tea person and you live in the Western New York area, send me a message. Maybe we can do a tea session. And I'm looking at your avatar, Mike, and I'm like, hey, Mike, why don't you come over and get some tea? But you know, it's if you're into tea, I don't know.
I do like tea, but I don't drink it often.
No. Well, I got good stuff.
Yeah. He's a snobby connoisseur, if that wasn't obvious.
Yes, I am.
I've always been a coffee guy, but I do enjoy my tea.
Okay.
What about you, Mike? What do you got going on?
Well, the Boogeyman's Closet is on hiatus, probably until July. The only episodes we'll have is a few specials. We have a few Patreon backer specials, and then we have like our anniversary. And if I can make it work, I have one other special that I would really like to do. It's just a matter of can I get the timing right. And then, of course, Count Creepyhead Saturday Morning Monster Mash, where three grown man children bitch about pop culture and talk about toys.
Always a good time. I don't even collect toys. In fact, sometimes when you guys are talking about the toys, I'm just like, okay, move on to like the silly stories and goofy impressions, guys.
Yeah.
And I love all the ridiculous games. So I'll mention that too. Creepyhead, Mike, Omei, we love all the silly games. The silly games are a nice touch that kind of mix things up and keeps it fun. For those of us who are like, I don't understand what you're talking about when you guys mention all that toy stuff, I'm just like, huh? I don't know. It sounds good to me. Sure. I guess reactions are good toys. I don't know. You say it so much. I guess they must be. I don't know.
I'm looking at about 40 of them on my desk right now.
Well, you have a problem, Mike.
I do. I really, really do.
You know, I'll say lately people really hate McFarlane in the comic industry as much as you guys seem to hate him in the toy industry as well. So that
Ooh,
guy.
I'm gonna have to get you to dish because I haven't heard that. But yes, he is pissing a lot of people off in the toy industry.
Yeah, well, the dish is just that he ran a contest for a Spawn cover from a fan, and an AI piece of art won the contest, which really lit a fire in the fan community. That, yeah, you know, a lot of people who, you know, created original art, you know, pen and ink and digital or whatever, that they were really put out that a extremely obvious AI piece of artwork, quote unquote artwork, you know, made got the winning vote. So, you know, and that has yet to be addressed by McFarlane camp as of this recording, so we'll see what the fallout is.
I know we might actually end up talking about this on Creepyhead, but Scott Knightlick, a former Mattel employee, the guy behind Masters of the Universe Classics, he goes by Toy Guru. Like, he's roundly hated by a lot of people because of the shit he did with Maddie Collector, but he has since gotten into it with a lot of people on YouTube since he no longer works for Mattel. But he is doing a fantasy comic, and he is using AI to do all of the art, and people are losing their shit on him because they're like, you know, dude, you know, like, you've worked with professional comic artists. You've worked with independent comic artists on all of the MOTU comics that came with Classics. And then you're basically going to spit in those people's faces and be like, yeah, I'm just going to pay for AI art. And it's like, dude, that's not cool. Like, especially when you know people that do this for a living. Like, come on.
Yeah, yeah. But there's definitely a huge backlash against AI art because of that. But yeah, anyway, just a little piece of dirt here at the end of the episode as we're wrapping things up. So I will say once again, thanks, Justin, for joining us. It's been a while since you were on the show. The last one was our Teen Wolf also episode. So hopefully we'll have to have you back sooner rather than later. And I think we have just the right episode in mind to do that sometime soon. But in the meantime, if you had fun listening to us and coming along on the ride for this Prayer of the Solar Babies episode, visit us on the socials, drop us a line, leave a comment, leave a podcast rating. Let us know what you think we should improve next time. And with that, I'm Josh.
I'm Mike.
And I'm Justin.
And we have to return some videotapes.
Raised by Rentals is a member of the Rad Pantheon Network. Visit radpantheon.com to support rad stuff. The theme music is Forbidden Fruit by Velvet Bethany. You can purchase music and learn more at velvetbethany.com.
I'm here with Space Jesus.
So am I a roller boy now?